everyone, and welcome to the Grant Street Experience. My name is Grant Irvin. I serve as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Pittsburgh. And we've been focusing in on the COVID-19 crisis on our podcast here about the people and the places and the activities that are happening along Grant Street here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. COVID-19 has kind of taken not just the city, but the nation and the world by storm in the recent months. What our purpose is over the next few episodes is to really start to focus in on some of the people and activities to help give us perspective on the challenges that we face with the COVID crisis. Today, we have Jessica Pickett with us. Jessica is the principal consultant with Tomorrow Global LLC, a local consulting firm that focuses in on public health issues and economics. Jessica and I had the privilege of kind of meeting each other a few years back, actually, while she was at the University of Pittsburgh's Global Studies Center and talking about the issues of resilience. And she's been an advisor to us on the development of our 1PGH resilience strategy. So we wanted to take a moment to get to know Jessica a little bit better and kind of the work that she does, both kind of locally and globally, but also kind of pick her brain a little bit to give us some perspective on the COVID-19 crisis from a public health standpoint. What some of the things that we can have some deeper analysis on in terms of perspective of what's happening right now, but then also look at issues going forward. So I'd like to welcome Jessica Pickett to the Grant Street Experience. Jessica, how are you today?
I'm doing well, and thanks so much for having me, Grant. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm always excited to talk with you and always excited to think through some of the challenges we're currently facing and our pathway out of them.
Excellent. Excellent. So maybe first off, just how are you doing in you personally in kind of this time of COVID-19, working from home and some of the challenges and opportunity that brings? How are you doing personally?
I really appreciate you asking that. And I'm very fortunate. So I, as a consultant, I was already working from home a lot. So I think while routine is always tricky from working from home, it's something I've had a little bit of a practice with. I've been planning to be doing some research out of the country this summer and fall, which of course I realized early was not quite feasible. But as a result of that, realizing that early enough, I think I may have adopted the last puppy in Pittsburgh. So I'm part of Team Pandemic Puppy. Hopefully he won't interrupt us today. It's been challenging to have a sense of what's coming, and I think I spotted the equity issues for some of our earlier conversations. I had spotted those pretty early on, so especially at the outset when there was a dissonance between how knowing how severe this was going to get, when people around me often didn't and thought I was being alarmist. So I actually found it harder earlier on with that dissonance. Now that most people kind of ramped up their response in giving greater awareness and unfortunately greater salience as this hits home for a lot of people, I've been able to move into being, I think, able to channel that more proactively. So as somebody who works on global health and development, this is something I can contribute to professionally. Through interactions like ours, of course, but also through looking at, for example, prospects for vaccines, like global vaccine policy and things like that. Awesome. So I'm lucky to be hanging in there.
Maybe that's great to hear and glad you're doing well. Maybe for folks, can you give a little bit of background on kind of your, both kind of your training and prior experience? You've had a wealth of knowledge, both kind of working globally in the public health space, but maybe tell folks a little bit about kind of your journey to where you are now.
Of course. So I'm a health economist by training. I completed my PhD at Wharton with a focus on the incentives in the healthcare system. Many of my colleagues and classmates and professors there are leading experts in the U.S. healthcare system. So I was very much trained and grounded in understanding how patients, providers, manufacturers, insurance companies respond to incentives in the healthcare system here. But my own research actually focused much more on how those same issues play out in low and middle income countries. And in particular in India, where I spent several years examining how consumer information or patient information about their own health, about the quality of care available, about their access to government government programs affected affected the quality and price of the care that they received. And these are issues we do see in the US as well. So it was is particularly stark as it hits poor rural families in low-income countries. There's fewer other protections in place. But many of the insights are the same here. You know, in particular, we see this, of course, now as everyone's dealing with a great deal of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But before graduate school, I had gotten my start in global health working at a think tank in DC called the Center for Global Development, and a brief time before that at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. And during that time, I was looking a little bit further upstream instead of just at the national and subnational health system level. I was looking at things like, how do we incentivize research and development for new vaccines and new drugs? How do we address incentives for better diagnostic capacity? All of these things, and in many cases, looking specifically at infectious diseases, of course. At the time, mostly AIDS, TB, and malaria, but also a number of vaccine-preventable childhood illnesses. So all of that kind of came together when I moved to Pittsburgh about 4 years ago now. I can't believe it's been that long. When I was working at Pitt's Global Studies Center, helping to design an undergraduate global health certificate that could leverage a lot of the university's amazing expertise at the graduate level in both public health and medicine, and make that more available to undergraduates in a systematic, legible way, and teaching my own course on the political economy of global health as part of that. It was a great opportunity to also think about how those issues played out beyond just health and beyond just internationally. Again, these are the provision of public goods and it's a big picture issue that's important to every area of government, nationally and locally. And working there was a great opportunity to expand my perspective to issues like those we see here in Pittsburgh. So about a year and a half ago now, 2 years ago, as much as I love Pitt, I stepped down from my full-time role there so I could bring some of those insights back more to the policy side in my role as the principal consultant with Tomorrow Global. And so it's been really great to have continued opportunities to work with you, looking at things around sustainable development here in Pittsburgh leading up to this. And it's been rewarding to be able to leverage some of that insight during the challenging time we now face.
Interesting. Yeah, that's terrific. It's kind of, you've become kind of a timely voice in terms of the crisis that we're seeing. I wonder for listeners, if we can attack this from like a global, national, and local level. I mean, maybe could you break down for folks just some perspective, like what we're seeing at the global level, in terms of like the World Health Organization and kind of the global response, then maybe at the national and then kind of here in the local level, like pandemic, when we started to work on kind of our 1PGH resilience strategy, it was one of the things that we identified as a risk that, the city could ultimately confront. But it was one of those, on the continuum of risks, high impact, low probability, right? Mm-hmm. So when you start to kind of model these things out, whereas, typically we could face a weather event like a flood or, impacts from a hurricane or things of that nature. Pandemic was relatively low, but it was definitely something on the continuum. And how has it metastasized, I guess, so fast in terms of, an event that started in Asia and then kind of rapidly spread across the world? So maybe if you can start there and explaining that for folks.
Absolutely. So first, I do want to give the caveat that when I talked about my training and my background, you'll notice I'm not either an epidemiologist or a virologist. And I think it's really very important to state those caveats up front. One of the challenges with this moment is there is so much uncertainty, even among experts, especially among experts, that knowing who you're taking, whose words you're taking at face value is critical. As much as credentialism is something I would normally react against. So, but with that caveat, some of the questions, like the big picture virology or epidemiology question that you're posing, I think we still don't know. Why did this metastasize so fast? They're still trying to figure that out. Just a couple of days ago, there's new data that suggests that in Washington State, for example, where there were the first confirmed cases and deaths here in the U.S., there were actual multiple different entry points. It was not, as originally assumed, a direct descent. The first deaths in the nursing home were not directly descended from a traveler returning from Wuhan. Mm-hmm. And they're seeing similar patterns elsewhere, which suggests that we don't know how fast a single introduction can translate into a devastating local outbreak. If we don't know how many different introductions just fizzled out entirely. And it's now looking like there's a lot of the latter, that there's a lot of times where community transmission just doesn't take off in one particular case. Mm-hmm. And that varies by disease. The extent to which everyone is equally infectious or and different routes of transmission. Here it looks like it's, I think the number I've seen recently was 10% of patients are responsible for something like 80% of transmission at each point. Hmm. But don't quote me on that. That data takes a long time to find, and you don't really even know to look for it until you have a pandemic. So almost always you're going to see the early stages in this kind of, I hate to say fog of war, but for lack of a better metaphor, we'll go with that.
Fair comparison, I think.
It is. If you want to, later we can revisit the challenges of metaphors. I do think that there's a lot of...
Language and terminology has been a difficult thing, I think, throughout the whole pandemic, right?
It is. And militarizing, and we've seen this in other epidemics, that militarizing language and metaphors, which are often used to bring additional funds, tend to determine how those funds are allocated and tend to result in a militaristic response that can backfire. So side note from the medical anthropologists out there. But anyway, to the point at hand, we're still learning, and it increasingly seems like there's a number of things about the nature of this virus that make it even greater uncertainty at the early stages than others. That said, I think I would disagree with the advice you were given early on about a pandemic being a high impact but low probability event. I think it's, for years now, we've known it's actually high probability, but there's nothing you can, it's much harder to control or to address at the local level. And reasonably, I think it was probably assumed that there'd be a much greater global and especially national response. So in terms of the impact on local, on Pittsburgh, I think it's understandable that it wasn't at the top of the list you would plan for. But we've known this is coming. There's a lot of things about how increasing urbanization, increasing human behaviors in general vis-a-vis the environment have made zoonotic diseases, that is, the transmission of diseases traditionally found in animal reservoirs into human hosts, more likely. And then, of course, with greater urbanization and population density, as well as greater globalization, so interconnection between different cities, greater risk that once it's in a human host, it can spread more broadly.
It's interesting you say that, because like one of the big things that have been the tenets of a lot of our urban resilience practice have been exactly those three things, right? Urbanization, globalization, and climate change.
Right.
And what you're saying actually is because of the confluence of those things, and going back to some of our early research, which started in like 2015, there's been a massive accelerator in those areas, right? Mm-hmm. So it almost kind of tips the scale. I take what you're saying correctly. It's like it tips the scale in the other direction because of the rate of change.
Yeah.
In terms of what that probability actually is.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And this isn't, this is happening globally. I want to be clear, like those trends, as I mean, I'm sure you know this, but I mean, I have a dear friend who, when she was living in an apartment downtown a year ago, a bat flew into her window on the 26th floor, got trapped in there. There was a lot of drama because of the bat, not because of my friend. But just so we're clear, there's no reason that this couldn't have been introduced here. I have other friends and colleagues who look at the ways we tend to think of disease as coming from somewhere else and otherizing it. Based on the epidemiology, I would assume that this was initially introduced in or around Wuhan. But it's just as likely that the next time we have a pandemic that it could be introduced even by a bat here in Pittsburgh.
In large part because the intermixings of kind of the human population infringing upon the animal population and vice versa, just because of urbanization practices and habitat disruptions.
Exactly that. So what I do think has been a surprise is that despite at the global level, I mean, there has been a lot of money poured in internationally to pandemic preparedness for a while now. This is, Bill Gates has spoken about this and been ringing the alarm bells for years. There's several other philanthropists and foundations that have also made pandemic preparedness and biosecurity a priority as one of several kind of long-term existential threats. There has been, in the US in particular, actually a lot of investment in the global health security agenda, as it's known, especially started under President George W. Bush after reading a history book about the influenza pandemic in 1918. So there had actually been a lot of attention to the risks of pandemics. And yet everybody I know who works in that sphere, which again, among another thing I said that is not my prior expertise, is global health security. I have tended to work more on routine illness and interactions with patients and providers, not unexpected outbreak of a novel disease. But I have several colleagues who do and who have. They have all expected that the World Health Organization would have been armed with better data early on. And the WHO has, for all of the legitimate critiques of how it operates and the constraints under which it operates, I think everybody, even its biggest expert critics, think that their handling is very well. But what we hadn't anticipated, and I think they should have, is that by its nature, the World Health Organization can only serve as a resource to member countries,
right,
and they rely on the data that national governments provide it. Mm-hmm. A lot of governments, including the US, but definitely not limited to it, had an incentive, political incentives, to underplay the severity of illness. They did not want to test people if they couldn't treat them. They didn't want to raise concerns about travel or economic implications if they didn't have to. And the WHO, just by its charter, can't force people to do that, force countries to do that. So there is a less coordinated response globally, and then of course nationally, here and elsewhere in the UK, among other, is a big example, but also in places like Tajikistan, which denied it to the last possible moment and now has the highest death rate in Central Asia. It's without a national response, there's not much you can do globally. And there's also not much you can do locally, because if with a shock like this, you need federal dollars.
Right. It's interesting too, the last kind of major shock that we've had, and this kind of goes into like your economics background a little bit, the idea of contagion. Mm-hmm. Part of my kind of academic training was in financial modeling and financial systems and the issues of financial contagion, looking at financial crises and things of that nature. And one of the things that's interesting is how similar this is to those crises, you know, whether it's a currency risk contagion or, you know, what we saw in the 2008 recession, the interrelationship between countries and the financial system and the health system. I'd be interested to hear about kind of your thoughts on the health systems. You know, that's where a lot of kind of your background is in, and their differences and how they've, because they're different, how they've responded to the crisis.
Absolutely. And I do think the contagion point, the point you make about how the spillovers between the economic system, the financial systems, I mean, that is playing out here as well, in addition to the health system itself, and in fact, interacting with it. For example, I believe that a lot of the pharma stocks, well, pharmaceutical company stocks and stock market in general are fluctuating a lot based on the daily, what clinical trials have just been published. But also when we hear calls for things like pharmaceutical manufacturers to bring all manufacturing back to the US, that is a fundamental shock to the industry if that were to happen. And the reason we're hearing that, so we're hearing this intersection of what happens when you have calls for nationalizing entire industries as essentially a global health security measure. That is, we want to make sure, we want to limit our exposure to supply chain shortages of not just, you know, not just potential vaccines, but even existing antibiotics. If as the financial markets and economic spillovers mean that there's an increasing a risk of shortage of those, what happens when they're all being manufactured in India or China, or their active ingredients, which I think 80 or 90% of them come from China? Is there a risk that those will be, that export will be banned? And India did actually try and do this briefly. So the tendency to, and we're seeing this also in the nationalist kind of race for a vaccine, where the US has, I think as a condition of some of its R&D investment, has asked, has demanded that vaccine manufacturers provide the first, you know, X number of doses to the US. And that, I'm not even saying that's necessarily unreasonable from a contractual perspective. There's all sorts of questions about how R&D federal investments are made based on, you know, using taxpayer dollars when there aren't guaranteed price concessions. There's a whole, like, that's a very complicated issue. But what we're seeing is that in the same way we started to see, we've seen countries not just shut down borders to prevent the spread of disease, but use the spread of disease as an excuse to shut down borders that they already wanted to. So per certain ongoing punitive immigration policies that are being floated here.
You see that in the economic sector now.
Yeah, exactly. You're also seeing that in the economic sector. And in terms of how it's playing out with different healthcare systems, what we have to think of is, so one of the reasons South Korea, for example, or Germany have been doing very well, relatively, is that their governments are, people have a lot of faith in their governments, which tend to be very kind of pro-science. They have, their doctors are, I mean, it's incredibly, I mean, these are great healthcare systems. They're also ones that are, for the most part, free. There's universal health coverage in a meaningful sense. Certainly not insurance that's tied to your job. So when people trust their doctors, can go to their doctors early on to be tested when there's, when there's better coordination between the government and a kind of less privatized slightly less privatized healthcare system, even though this is still, those are both, I believe, largely private providers. When you have that upstream single payers or better coordination among your payers, you can both get people in, give people confidence to go see their doctors and have faith in the system, which is really important, and be able to adjust your strategies and allocate your supplies better to ensure that that's met. Whereas in the US, there's so little coordination that when it when it comes to a truly infectious disease, when the people are most at risk of getting sick are also the ones at most at risk of losing their job mm-hmm. and losing their insurance. Who do they go to get tested? How do they get treatment if they need it? Mm-hmm. What are the social safety mechanisms in place to make sure that they're not ideally not losing their job, but even if they're losing their job, at least not losing any source of income. So the U.S. healthcare system and its broader social policies has made it a much bigger challenge here than in other comparably wealthy countries.
And how's that played out locally? Trust in institutions and trust building is a primary kind of resilience practice. Like building resilience requires building trust, you know, from the community level, like on up. I mean, what are some of the things that you've seen, you know, both good and kind of needs to improve, I think, here locally?
So my understanding from the last time I looked at this data is that Allegheny County, for example, had been unusually compliant with stay-at-home orders. That reflects very much like a trust in government and social cohesion. My understanding is that relative to many other U.S. settings, and certainly relative to other counties outside Allegheny County, mask wearing is quite high. So in that sense, like the trust in government and, you know, what political economists would call social capital is quite, and social cohesion is quite high here. So that's been very good when we're, you know, at this early stage of trying to, as everyone was saying, flatten the curve. However, the idea of flattening the curve, as it was originally kind of put out there, was that that would be buying time to get the things you need in place. So when it peaked, it would not overwhelm the healthcare system. You'd have better treatment options. You would be able to test and trace and kind of identify people at risk and prevent the spread. Much of that was unfortunately not done. Again, lack of federal funding and prioritization. So
kind of providing that backfill of support.
Exactly.
That's needed to support local governments.
Exactly. I've been very impressed. I'm incredibly impressed with the local response at the city level. And I've been impressed with, you know, when I've spoken to mayors at some of the surrounding boroughs, they've been very confident in, I've been incredibly impressed by Governor Wolf and Secretary Levine, just amazed. And in fact, I know we kind of skipped straight from like the global national to the local without talking about the state. And I've been quite impressed so far by how the state is handling it. And I've been impressed that mayors of kind of the surrounding municipalities outside the city of Pittsburgh have also been very, at least last time I spoke to them, were very confident in trusting state orders. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I worry that people don't realize that without those additional backbone in place, that just really would require additional, frankly, there's a whole host, it requires federal resources financially, but also in terms of coordination. It looks like we may have to go the route of different state systems for contact tracing and different databases that way.
A more regional approach, like between states?
Right. Interesting. But it should have been national. I mean, this is why the CDC exists, and they've been sidelined. So given that everyone had assumed it would be national because it should be national, I think it took longer to kind of move towards the second best solution of a regional approach. All that's to say, my assumption is that insofar as we trust the testing data coming out of Allegheny County, assuming the testing data is accurate and that we've been hit less hard than other places, then a greater proportion of our population is still susceptible. And so when measures are lifted, I think are likely to see an even greater spike relative to other states or regions, just because
which requires continued vigilance, I guess, is what
the... Exactly, it requires continued vigilance. We should not assume that we are reopening and then that's
everything's back to normal.
Yeah. Right, we should assume that once we go green, we're gonna eventually have to go back to yellow or back to red. And you know, this is not just what happens within the city or the county, but what happens in surrounding regions and areas. Especially, you know, there's the city doesn't exist in isolation. The county doesn't exist in isolation. And relative to other parts of the country, we have a lot of relatively small counties. So when you have, you know, surrounding counties that say that they're not going to follow they're not going to enforce state orders. Mm. I don't see why why residents there are any more likely to not come in, like continue to come into Pittsburgh if they want. So it's going to be tricky there. We are lucky that we do have, with UPMC, we do have a huge excess capacity of ICU beds. It is unlikely we are going to overwhelm hospital systems at least in Pittsburgh, which is great news. I have been a little concerned that creates some perverse incentives when they were the ones also doing most of the testing. As of this week, speaking about other local, like good local news, there's now free testing available through the county in partnership with Curative. So like this week I've been feeling even more optimistic about how things will play out here. Pitts, one of the University of Pittsburgh's vaccine candidates, was just acquired by Merck, which is one of the largest vaccine companies. So in terms of both in terms of it, Merck making an acquisition, I think is very promising news about the quality of the candidate.
And the ability to scale too, probably, right?
And the ability to scale, absolutely. So I think see that as would be promising, even if there wasn't a Pittsburgh connection. To the extent there is a Pittsburgh connection, I have no idea what the commercialization contracts look like coming out of the university, but I would hope that does hedge against some of the higher ed spillovers that I know Peter Walker talked about on this podcast last week.
Yeah, you know, maybe just in the last couple of minutes we have together, you've also kind of, you've just brought up the issues of vaccines. I mean, what are things that people can look in terms of like the what's coming, right? And the work that's being done in the vaccine space. Not that you're a forecaster or have a crystal ball or anything, but can you explain kind of like some of the work that's being done right now in terms of the system for folks?
So I want to start by pointing out like vaccines have saved more lives than any other human invention ever. And not just in terms of health interventions. Vaccines are wonderful. They are safe. There are some individuals who can't take them for specific health reasons. There are the occasional rare side effects, which is why we have such rigorous testing protocols and clinical trials. They are wonderful. And one of the tragedies is that immunization rates for other diseases have fallen off a cliff during this pandemic because parents are understandably concerned about taking their children to a clinic now. So it is.
But like normal vaccines like chickenpox or MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, exactly. And things like that have. So, well, like
in other countries, polio is likely to make a resurgence despite it being just on the verge of eradication. Measles, the outbreaks in the US have been bad, they've been even worse globally. Even among parents who deeply believe in vaccines, countervailing concerns right now have made them hesitate where they might not. Supply chains have been disrupted, so even parents who want to and are willing to take the risk might not be able to get them. Funding priorities have changed. Frontline health workers are at risk. So it's already a big challenge. It's also, despite early optimistic hopes that they're realizing that infectious disease kills people, having it more salient might quash some anti-vax and vaccine hesitancy discourse. It seems to be the opposite. The last survey I saw earlier this week, I want to say it was 20% of Americans surveyed said that they would not accept a COVID-19 vaccine if it were available.
Because about, it's not proven?
My understanding, I would have to look at how it was phrased. I think it was more, they won't take any vaccines. They're just anti-vax. Another were unsure whether they, another equally sized group were unsure that whether they would take it. And about 50% said they would, I think. When I was driving through Mercer County 2 weeks ago, after stay-at-home orders had been lifted, which is why I was out driving, and not interacting with anybody, just us and our canoe and our dog, there was still protesters outside the county courthouse there. Now the stay-at-home orders had been lifted. They were protesting masks and vaccines. So you're already seeing this confluence. So we need to, it's not just about when a vaccine is available, it's about do people trust it and will they take it? And that's important because, as I said, the reason vaccines are safe is because they have such a high hurdle for safety trials. Mm-hmm. I am a little concerned that we might, we need a vaccine to get us out of this, but we need a good one. Yeah. I don't love that the big investment by the US government is called Operation Warp Speed. We do not want to trade off safety
for quality.
An additional couple of months. It is not worth it, not just for this disease, which is to see potential side effects, but because it could undermine trust in vaccines more generally. That said, there's something, I think at last count, 110 candidates in preclinical and clinical trials, mostly preclinical. A handful are already have started human trials. Most of the data of those first generation ones that are in human trials, although this has is nothing like the flu in any other way, the one way it might be is from the experience of the patient experience of getting vaccinated, insofar as it looks like these early candidates might be effective for a short period of time at preventing the disease in some people who get it and reducing the severity of those who do. But it is not, and then you would need another booster. This is not like the experience of getting, you know, a measles vaccine as a child with a few boosters and then you're done and protected for life for sure.
It's not a one and done type
of thing. It's not a one and done. At least the first generation. Some of the candidates that they are, the early ones, the advanced candidates, had been developed originally for SARS back in 2003. And so they might be at later stages in the process, but may or may not work as well for this disease. So all that's to say, I am not optimistic about getting a vaccine within the next 12 months that is still a vaccine people will be taking in 5 years. I mean, we might get ones that if you get it in the next 12 months, you then have to keep taking it every year for the next 5 years. But I think we're the second generation. I think it's going to be 2 to 3 years based on what I know, based on conversations with and articles from the people I trust most, that we should expect it to be 2 or 3 years before you and I get a vaccine that we are comfortable that we think will protect us for life or has a chance of protecting us for life or at least protecting us for a year. Even if 2 or 3 years we might be getting, we should assume more frequent boosters.
Jessica, just to maybe kind of wrap up here, because we're coming up against time, you know, one of the common themes it seems is, you know, as we've been having the conversation, is this importance of trust. Trust in institutions, trust in process, trust in science. Are there any kind of, pithy kind of next steps or kind of ways in which you would see kind of continuing to build these trusts, trust in kind of this process, which ultimately kind of builds resilience? Any kind of thoughts or suggestions you might offer up?
Oh, that is a brilliant question. And one I don't have a pithy ready answer for. I guess what I would say, to kind of situate this within many of the larger conversations you and I have had, is that we've talked a lot about equity or the lack of it in the region. And in the context of COVID-19, we've talked about how the economic implications and even the short-term, you know, distribution of illness will exacerbate those inequalities. And so any long-term recovery needs to be taking equity into concern. But I would say that beyond that, in terms of resilience against future pandemics, of which unfortunately there will be more. Improving equity is crucial to building trust, because again, if the people who are most at risk structurally, for economic reasons, for racial reasons, are systematically the ones who understandably don't trust the government as much. When, I mean, we've seen the news out of Minneapolis, when people don't believe the government, whether that's government health workers or scientists, like the Tuskegee trials, or first responders, including police officers, mayors in terms of their policing strategies. When people feel systematically feel like their lives are not valued, why should they have trust in institutions, including doctors, including local experts and advisors? So I think that the way to be thinking about improving trust is by really centering equity as an issue, not only in terms of recovery from this crisis, but in terms of resilience to future ones.
That's terrific. Why don't we just leave it at that? Because that's a great remark. So I'd like to thank Jessica Pickett for being our guest today on the Grant Street Experience. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, Jessica, as always, to kind of learn about what's going on in kind of your world and your research and the work that you do. But really appreciate you sharing that with kind of the listeners and the residents here in the city of Pittsburgh. It's great to know that we have people like you that are working on these issues each and every day to help improve our city. So we really appreciate you and the work that you do. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Grant. This was a pleasure, and I look forward to continue working with you.
Excellent. So once again, I'm your host, Grant Irvin. This is the Grant Street Experience, and we'll be with you shortly with our next episode as we continue on this journey of learning more about kind of COVID-19 and the impacts that it has on the city of Pittsburgh, and how we can build more resilience in our city and our response to this crisis and the others that we face. Thank you very much, and we'll see you in our next episode. Take care.